Panel number two this morning is Perspectives on Enforcement of Disability Law. The lead presenter this morning is the Assistant Attorney General and Chief of the Civil Rights Division of the Office of the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And we have two commentators. The Chief of the Civil Rights Division is Maura Healy, who is in the office, as I say, of the Attorney General. In September of 2008, the Attorney General's office and the National Federation of the Blind reached an agreement with the Apple Company that will provide blind consumers and students with full access to Apple's iTunes and iTunes U. Timothy Fox is our first commentator. He is the co-founder of Fox and Robertson PC in Denver. He was class counsel in Lucas versus Kmart, which brought in the largest settlement of a disability rights public accommodations case in the United States. The other person in that firm is Amy Robertson. And she practices in all areas of civil rights law with an emphasis on disability rights. They're from Colorado, and I'm told that there will be 30 inches of snow in Colorado today, so they're glad to be here instead.
We're just staying.
We may be here for a while.
The chief of the Civil Rights Division. Interrupt to say that Amy Robertson has sat with some of us in negotiations on a case we had, and she's a tough-minded lady, but all of the people on this panel are tough-minded people. The chief of the Civil Rights Division of the Office of Attorney General in Massachusetts, who has been a dramatic element in bringing accessibility to students on college campuses, is Moira Healy. Please welcome her for the beginning of this.
Moira, where are you going to do this?
I'm going to sit here at the table, if that's all right.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you.
Can you turn it on?
How's this? Try to talk. How's that? Okay, good. Thank you very much, Dr. Maurer, and thank you for the privilege of being here and giving me the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I want to thank Dr. Maurer and the National Federation of the Blind, as well as the sponsors of this wonderful symposium for this experience. And I'm so pleased to be joined by Amy and Tim, who I've come to know over the last couple of years through some litigation that we've been involved with, and just terrific and tenacious, effective litigators and advocates. And also hello to our good friend Dan Goldstein, who's led the charge on so much of this. So I was asked to speak a little bit about enforcement and provide a perspective on enforcement. And I do so as a person in the Attorney General's office in the state of Massachusetts. So my perspective is informed by my experiences within that jurisdiction, though I hope it offers some applicability to the work that you all are engaged in. A little bit of overview and context. Our state attorney general's office is, unlike some other states, where it's a separately elected position. I work and report to our attorney general, Martha Coakley. And one feature is that for the last 50 years or so, the position, the office of the civil rights division has been a by statute designated with a special duty and role within the office. There, not every state attorney general's office has a civil rights division, and I'm not aware of any other office that has one that's actually codified by statute. And I say that it's important to me not because of some sort of job security that it affords me, but rather because I think it's symbolic of the priority and the importance placed on civil rights in our state. Further, following passage of the ADA, our division sought to establish a special unit within the division. It's the Disability Rights Unit, and again, I think it's important because it provides a priority and a recognition of the much-needed work that we can look to do using the powers of the state government. That's a little bit of background. I was interested and have been interested in reading Dr. Tenbrook's law review articles and commentary on the issue, and he really was such an incredible trailblazer in paving the way for the development of legal theories with applicability beyond that. It was not limited to the area of disability rights. But you certainly see the effect he had on efforts within civil rights more generally. When he talks about integration and participatory justice, those ideals and principles ring as true today as they did then. And indeed, I look at our mission within the work that we do in our office as being to protect and ensure that all residents in Massachusetts have access, equal and fair and meaningful access to all aspects of a civic society, be it in housing, employment, education, financial services, credit, voting, health care, and the like. Because truly, as he says, the right to live in the world means really the right to make one's way into that world, and we must do all that we can to ensure that right is brought to life and made real every day. As I say, disability rights have been for a long time a priority for our office, and I'm fortunate to be blessed with the support of both the governor and the attorney general on this front. Over the years, we've done work, extensive work in the area of Before mentioning that, I should sort of tell you that my view of enforcement is actually quite broad, and I enjoy the position that I'm in because it's an opportunity to think about and apply enforcement in a few different ways. Certainly, enforcement involves investigation and the threat of lawsuits or litigation. That's really important. It also, though, involves an ability to be part of legislation and policymaking initiatives, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And finally, it involves education and outreach. Part of, I think part and parcel really of the work of a public law enforcement agency is to think about enforcement as having multiple components, the litigation, the policy work, and the necessary outreach and education. Over the years, we've done work in a number of areas. We work, of course, in public accommodation, and this can range from providing guidance and counsel to cities and municipalities to ensure access to meetings and events. In Boston, we've met each year with the Boston Red Sox as they put forward their plans for the upcoming seasons and how they're going to ensure access for persons with disabilities. We've undertaken enforcement efforts ranging from pursuing CVS, which at the time was the largest pharmaceutical company, largest drugstore company in Massachusetts, to ensure appropriate aisle access. And most recently,
we, over this winter, obtained a six-figure settlement against a bus company that, quite unbelievably, refused to permit a couple, the couple was blind, to travel with their service animal on the bus. That work continues. It continues even more so in the area of housing and applying the Fair Housing Act and also our state anti-discrimination law to ensure that real estate property managers, landlords, housing authorities even have in place the appropriate anti-discrimination and reasonable accommodation policies. We spent a lot of time and have obtained numerous consent judgments over the last couple of years against entities, and my view is, from an enforcement perspective, it's important to ensure that going forward the right policies and protocols are adopted and in place so that we avoid replication of the same problems. And that's in addition to collecting money and the like on behalf of individual victims. I want to talk a little bit about what it is, I think, an attorney general's office, a state attorney general's office, can add to enforcement of disability law. I'll also talk a little bit about some of the limitations that are present, but ultimately, I hope that you can see the power and the opportunity that's there through potential collaboration with your state attorney general's offices. So, what is it that a state attorney general's office can contribute to enforcement? First off, I think we have the benefit of being able to access a whole panoply of causes of action and legal theories. We can, at least in Massachusetts, enforce state and federal law through parens patriae authority. We have the ability to intervene in actions and take positions on behalf of the public interest. In addition to being able to access a broad array of causes of action, we can also, I think, bring to bear a certain a weight or stature. And attorney generals tend to get their calls returned, and they tend to garner attention in a pretty responsive fashion. And each state is different, each attorney general's office is different, and there's different resources and priorities and levels of receptiveness. But if you can get your state attorney general on board and spend the time educating them, informing them about the issues, you can really have, I think, a powerful ally in your fight. Beyond sort of atmospheric and symbolic strengths that I think an attorney general's office brings to a matter, there are actually a fair number, I think, of substantive and strategic benefits as well. Perhaps the most powerful benefit or strength is our ability to use certain investigatory tools pre-litigation. That is to say, before we file suit, we have the ability to send voluntary requests for information to entities we believe have discriminated. We can go so far as to subpoena those entities. We can also subpoena third parties who we think have information relevant to that investigation. And our subpoenas call for oral testimony, so we can have people in essentially and get them to provide on the record testimony about a matter. But also, we get them to provide documents or a look at software or just access generally to the information in their possession. And the reason that's important, and I think a real benefit to enforcement efforts is that it gives us tremendous leverage over parties as we contemplate litigation. And it's information, it's an information advantage that you're not going to have if you're a private litigant. So we can build our case and basically know the universe of documents and information and testimony we're likely to see even before we bring suit. And that obviously puts us in a much stronger bargaining position at the outset of any litigation. And given the limited resources of our office, we want to spend the time up front making sure that we've collected all that information so that we know before we go down the road what it is we're going to see, and we can ensure as best possible that we're bringing the strongest case possible. In addition to our pre-litigation tools, I think another benefit of working with a state AG's office is that they have access to a network nationwide through the National Association of Attorneys General. Now, you can get your state AG on board on a particular initiative, and he or she can then look to reach out to other attorneys general across the nation to sign on to an amicus brief, to intervene in an action, to sign on to a comment letter to Congress, for example. Another way in which I think your state attorney general's offices can be helpful is that while we have strong enforcement and litigation tools at our disposal, we also have a lot of policy making or policy affecting tools at our disposal. And I don't think that these are utilized to quite the extent that they can be utilized. For instance, most attorney general's offices have the ability to issue opinion letters and to issue advisories. We've done this in Massachusetts recently, again reminding people of their obligations with respect to service animals. It's a relatively easy thing to do and to generate, but when we have that and we're able to generate an advisory and give it to our constituents and the various advocacy groups, they can then take that and give it to their consumers and clients and get the word out about what it is that people need to be doing. So those are just a couple of examples of ways that an AG's office can issue something, and it's public record, and it's there for public dissemination. AG's offices also have the power to convene hearings. We certainly see our federal Congress convening hearings and committees convening hearings on any number of issues. Attorney General's offices have that same power. So if you're wanting to focus attention on a particular issue, that's another avenue you could consider pursuing with your Attorney General's office. Similarly, at least in Massachusetts, our Attorney General can draft legislation. She can certainly weigh in support of legislation promulgated by others, but she can also take the bull by the horns, so to speak, and we can draft our own legislation. And finally, there's certainly the added benefit of the bully pulpit and the ability to garner attention to issues because you're the Attorney General. Another way that we can, I think, be helpful, and this goes to some of the comments made by Mr. Dale earlier and others in the audience, it's so important to get things right on the front end. And one of the roles that each AG's office serves, in addition to advocating for the public interest, is they serve as counsel to the state agencies. And we know that our state agencies and state actors don't always get it right. it's very important that an attorney general's office be there to help steer and direct appropriate action and appropriate consideration for the law. Mr. Dale referenced something that happened a few weeks ago with the stimulus funding. And as he noted, what happened there is that someone within the governor's administration had an idea that to expedite receipt of stimulus funding, they would basically provide a blanket variance to developers with respect to Architectural Access Board requirements. You can call it thoughtlessness, misunderstanding, misinformation, misapprehension, what have you. The bottom line is it was wrong. It was not something that the governor was aware of. But when we heard about it within the AG's office through the advocates, we were able to get in touch with folks in the administration, and ultimately that was made right. But those are the kinds of roles and situations where you want your AG's office to be involved, where policy decisions, protocols are being established up front, and you want to be at the table making sure that these issues are properly considered and addressed at the front. Finally, I think the benefit to having an AG's office involved is that you have the ability to educate, do outreach to people. I find so many times that one of the basic problems is that people just don't know the law, don't understand the capabilities of people with disabilities, and as Mr. Dale alluded to this morning, just don't get it and don't seem to appreciate how things can work. And we know, and I think it was Dr. Tenbrook himself that said that disability is as much about the attitudes of society as about the characteristics of any individual. And one of the roles that we have as chief law enforcement officer for a state is to make sure that people are educated. So those are all the positives about trying to collaborate and work with a state attorney general's office. Let me tell you a little bit about what some of the limits of that collaboration might be. One is that if you make outreach to your attorney general, you always run the risk of losing a certain amount of control over the matter. You have to I guess that goes with any form of collaboration, but it doesn't become your own. It becomes an initiative that you're both involved with. And my experiences have only been positive and beneficial, but that, of course, is the danger in working with someone else. Another limit is that it does take time to get the attention of an attorney general's office. They don't have as many resources as you would think in terms of staffing, and they have many issues that come across their plate on a day-to-day basis. So the more you can do up front in terms of preparing sort of briefing materials that are clear, that are easy to sort of understand and digest, legal research and the like, to sort of show them and guide them along, probably the more quickly you're going to be able to have them take up the ball and run with something. Another limitation is that the Attorney General is focused on state-specific relief for the most part. And that may or may not comport with the relief that you're ultimately seeking in the case. We oftentimes will do things like get settlements where there's some sort of CyPray relief that goes into a general fund that's for a particular organization or cause. It's not necessarily individual-specific relief or plaintiff-specific relief. That's not to say that there aren't ways to achieve that in a collaboration with an attorney general's office over litigation, but there is a difference in probably perspective in terms of what it is what end we're seeking to fulfill and what end an individual plaintiff might be seeking to fulfill. And finally, another limitation from a litigation perspective is that we are subject to public records law, and so a lot of what we do is transparent and an open book, and there's limited, there are more limits on attorney-client privilege, more limits on attorney work product and the like. It's not to say that there aren't ways to work around that through common interest agreements and the like, but it's just something to be mindful of when you are in communication with a public office like that. I want to talk a little bit about collaboration and how terrific it's been to collaborate and to work with advocacy groups and why that's such a beneficial experience. Groups will bring to our attention the issues really that are most important and the issues that we should focus on, issues that could otherwise get lost in sort of our day-to-day enforcement efforts. And second, they help us to formulate, I think, the most effective and meaningful and appropriate remedy for situations. So I think it's a situation that allows both us and organizations and advocates to leverage sort of the best of experience and expertise to really get the optimal result in a matter. Advocacy organizations, in particular their ability and their contact with consumers and clients to tell the stories, to help build the case, are so important. Those are things that are harder for us a step removed to do and to develop. And ultimately, this goes along with leveraging expertise and experience. This collaboration really helps, I think, everyone involved conserve resources and not duplicate efforts. And given where we are right now and the lack of funding for organizations, lack of reduced funding in terms of contributions and the like, it's in everyone's interest to try to maximize the work that can be done by a public interest agency such as ours and the ways in which, you know, think about the ways in which we can work together. So before I close, I just wanted to touch on an example of some of the collaboration that we've done, I think, pretty effectively with, in particular, this terrific organization, the NFB. And I mention it for two reasons. One, to illustrate the power of collaboration, but two, to illustrate what I think is a critical role for an entity such as an attorney general's office. The first comment there is that I think that too often our public accommodations, they simply have failed to consider changing circumstances. And I think you've talked about this in the past, Dr. Maurer, how the application of the law needs to change with changing circumstances. And as our technology and technological capabilities improve and expand, that generates further opportunities for people with disability, but it also generates additional obligations. I don't mean additional in the sense that they're not already there. I think that these obligations are already rest within the ADA and other statutes. But it's our job, I think, as a law enforcement agency to make sure that those that needs are being taken into account as technology changes and improves. We all know that at the time, for example, that the ADA was signed into law, we were sort of in a pre-internet age. And the definitions and examples of places of public accommodation really reflected sort of the brick and mortar reality of the time. But the ADA, I think, in the law and in the legislative history certainly surrounding its enactment, was written to be flexible enough to adapt to the changing capabilities of technology. And so a few years ago, we were approached by the NFB with the concern about ATMs and access and the ability of the blind people to access ATMs. And I was heartened to hear Mr. Dale say this morning how empowered he feels now in being able to go and access an ATM. And we recognize that and really credit the NFB for bringing that to our attention, because together with them, we were able to bring suit against the nation's largest ATM owner and operator, and were able to in December of 2007 secure a terrific agreement with them that requires them to be made accessible. And for us as an office, that experience, though it ended up being a fair amount of litigation and a lot of motions and battles waged in the courtroom over various issues, for us as an office, it was really, really important. And I think what it has done has sparked an interest in expanding what we learned and were able to obtain through that litigation to other areas. And in his introduction, Dr. Maurer referenced what happened with Apple last year. And again, it was a situation where NFB approached us and shared with us the concerns they had about Apple and in particular its iTunes service. And iTunes at the time, of course, we knew to be perhaps the most popular form of it was the most popular service for obtaining movies and music, entertainment, all that good stuff. But for us, an even greater and increasing concern was the extent to which it was being used in classrooms and was being used by universities and colleges across the country to load up course materials, lectures, and the like. And ultimately, we were able to negotiate a terrific resolution with Apple using some of the things I talked about earlier in terms of voluntary requests and subpoenas and the like. And, you know, initially we got the reaction we often get from folks, which is law doesn't apply to us, and here are all of our legal defenses. But, you know, over time and in relatively short order, we were able to work with them and impress upon them the need to make this right. And we were really pleased to see that happen, and I do hope that it leads to further to other companies taking note of their obligations. I think the work around websites, the work around the internet, given the fact that online commerce is sort of increasingly the most popular mode of commerce, it's really, really important that all of these sites be made accessible. And I know that we as an office are going to continue to look for ways to expand the efforts in that area. I should close by again reiterating that I hope that you can use some of what I've told you and shared with you to think about ways to reach out to your attorney general in your states and see and explore ways you can work together to really impact enforcement. Thanks.
I think you did a magnificent job. I appreciate that in the settlement as well as the presentation. Our first commentator is Tim Fox, and he is the person who got the biggest settlement so far in disability litigation. Well, no, not a litigation. This is a settlement. There was litigation involved, though, and so because getting big settlements has to do with whether or not there is a recognized disability law, corpus of law in the United States, it's an honor to welcome Tim Fox.
Thank you. Actually, my law partner, Amy Robertson, will be going first because she's going to be pointing out some problems that I hopefully will be giving some solutions to. And let me also correct the record. I worked on Kmart. Amy was lead counsel on Kmart. So
we're a team.
Yes.
Well, so I'm going to jump in, Dr. Maurer, if that's okay.
Get on the mic.
Oh, here, is this? It's on? Okay, I just have to be taller. It's hard for me. I also want to join Maura in thanking the NFB very much for hosting this symposium and for the other participants. Our task is to give a perspective on enforcement, and my perspective is there's no better way to enforce the law than in collaboration with an AG's office like Maura, working with Maura, and with a powerful organization like the NFB and people like Dan Goldstein, who put together teams like that. So that's it's an amazing way to just amplify our voices and the voices of our clients. But to underscore the need for collaboration like this and the need to find co-counsel and litigating partners and so on, I want to point out a very specific challenge that we encounter in our practice. It's something I alluded to in my question, which I think was characterized as professorial, which is, I guess that's kind of a compliment, but I'm hoping that I can unpack it a little and so that people can see the practical effects of this problem, and it doesn't just sound like a law nerd problem, which it is, I guarantee you. We are a private civil rights firm. It consists of Tim and me, a legal assistant, a law clerk, and two dogs. And what we do is we largely practice in what you could call the non-damages area of disability rights law. We very occasionally will take on an employment case, but very, very rarely. So our practice is generally in largely under Title III, which has no damages remedy. And then we do a lot of work under Title II and the Rehab Act, which are sort of parallel in a lot of ways. And the type of work we do ends up involving very little damages. It's policy changes, reasonable accommodations, and a lot of facilities access, a lot of physical access cases. And then we do some work under the Fair Housing Act. Again, generally, where injunctive relief in our cases will vastly outweigh the damages. And the problem stems from a single Supreme Court case called Buchanan. I've never really been sure how to pronounce it. Maybe Sam can correct my pronunciation if I'm wrong. But okay, we'll go with that. And this case held that most civil rights cases have fee shifting. So if the plaintiff wins, the defendant pays the plaintiff's fees. Under the Buchanan decision, the court held that if the case becomes moot before there's an actual judgment entered, before you get summary judgment or trial or a consent decree, a settlement that involves a judicial component, if the case gets mooted out, then there are no fees. So no matter how hard you've worked, and even if the defendant is basically changing his or her conduct in response to your lawsuit, no fees. And this is important not just because we personally like to eat and pay the rent on time,
so do the dogs.
We have to keep them in dog food. It's really turned into an impediment to bringing cases, and specifically to bringing single barrier or single plaintiff individual cases solving small and medium-sized problems. Tim is going to talk about in a second how we've addressed this procedurally by bringing gigantic cases, and that's great. But every case can't be a class action, and every case, probably Maura can testify, we can't bring the Massachusetts Attorney General, the Colorado Attorney General, every case on our docket. But so let me take a little bit of a running start at this concept of why this is important. And again, many of you may be familiar with this. These fee shifting provisions, shifting the fees onto the defendant when the plaintiff prevails, is a way of essentially enlisting the private bar and private plaintiffs as what they actually call private attorneys general, with all due respect. And there's a great passage in a 1968 Supreme Court case called Newman versus Piggy Park Enterprises. And incidentally, I want to sue more defendants called Piggies. I think that would be a lot of fun.
A South Carolina company.
Is it? probably so. The court said, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, it was evident that enforcement would prove difficult and that the nation would have to rely in part upon private litigation as a means of securing broad compliance with the law. So the Supreme Court and Congress, when it passed the law, is anticipating using private enforcement to enforce, at that time, the Civil Rights Act. And in that case in particular, was the public accommodations, came up under the public accommodations provision of that law. So the court goes on to say, If successful plaintiffs are routinely forced to bear their own attorney's fees, few aggrieved parties would be in a position to advance the public interest by invoking the injunctive powers of the federal court. So it really is, again, enlisting private attorneys to take on righteous cases and get paid at the end of the day, so this incentive. Now, the question then comes up, what happens if the defendant starts doing the right thing, stops the conduct that you're challenging in the middle of your litigation? And that's great. You've achieved what you wanted. They've stopped keeping African Americans out of the swimming pool, I think, was the Newman case. Or they install the ramp, or they change their policy about service animals in the middle of the case. Back in the day, back before 2001, virtually every federal court that addressed this issue, and every circuit but the Fourth Circuit, did we have a comment from South Carolina there? Would grant the plaintiff the fees under a theory called the catalyst theory. So the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney had been the catalyst for changing the behavior or getting the ramp or getting rid of the racist policy. And the plaintiff, if he could show this catalyst relationship, would get his fees. This changed under, in the single case, the Buchanan case in 2001, where the Supreme Court followed the Fourth Circuit and did away with this catalyst theory. Now, what's interesting to me is in the decision, and this really focuses on why this is a big problem for Title III and why it's a big problem for areas where injunctive relief dominates the type of relief you're asking for. Because in the decision, the court, you can see the court sort of struggling with trying to justify this decision as to why this is not as big a problem as we might think it is. So the court says, and I should say the key holding of the court is you have to have a judicial decision to get your fees. So you have to have either a judgment or a consent decree. It's not enough to have a private settlement or change in behavior. So the court says, well, the petitioner, what about the concept that defendants might scurry around and try to moot out the claims just to get out from under having to pay fees? And the court says, don't worry, that only happens with equitable relief. When there are damages at issues, they can't moot the case out. Well, welcome to our world. That's Title III. Title III of the ADA, which applies to public accommodations, has no damages remedy. So that little piece of snark on the part of the court was that's our practice. But what they went on to say, it's really hard. Note two, the court says, it's hard to moot out a claim. Voluntary compliance won't render the case moot unless it's very, very clear that the wrongful behavior could not be expected to recur. So they're trying to reassure us on a couple of fronts. But again, this isn't a special problem for Title III access cases, because often you'll have a situation where the action that you've asked for and that has occurred is the installation of a ramp or remodeling a restroom, something that's very physical and very installing talking technology, something that's fairly unlikely to come undone. And so in case after case now, in single case after single case, individual cases, they are being mooted out. The courts are saying, well, shoot, they've installed the ramp. What are they going to do, take it out? So in this particular area where we practice, Title III has become very, very susceptible to this Buchanan problem. And it has, you can see this having real-world consequences. If you look on PACER, we have a Westclip service that delivers decisions in Title III and decisions in any relevant cases every morning to our email inbox. The Title III cases are being brought in states with damages remedies. And the decisions are coming out largely of California and Florida, occasionally a couple of other states, but the smaller single barrier cases are simply not happening in cases where you can't team up with the Attorney General or bring a damages claim or do some of the other things that Tim's going to talk about. So, and the broader effect here is in these states, businesses have no incentives to comply. And businesses will know that they can wait for the litigation to be filed or the demand letter or even for the litigation to be filed and litigated for a couple of years before they actually have to go and make some of these changes. So this has taken away a key enforcement tool for public accommodations. And again, before we get to the answer of turning every case into a gigantic class action, there are a couple of things, other things that we do to try to address this. But I want to stress, this is why I jumped the gun a little and raised this with Mr. Dale earlier, this needs a legislative solution, and it's a very easy legislative solution. It involves changing the definition of prevailing party, and so, you know, to the extent that I'm talking to an audience of movers and shakers in the disability rights world, this is something that needs to be fixed to make Title III enforceable again. But to get back to Maura's theme, one of the key things that we've done to help sort of amplify the voices and the effectiveness of a single person with a single barrier include things like collaboration. We've had the privilege of working with Maura's organization. We've worked with the NFB. We work a lot with the Colorado Cross Disability Coalition in Colorado. On the government side, one of the things we'll often do with a single barrier case in Colorado is to take advantage of these investigatory powers that Maura was talking about. We file with our Colorado Civil Rights Division, and most states have a state civil rights agency. Because before you invoke the power of the federal court and you know, spend a lot of costs on experts and attorney time, you'll get an investigation, get the results of the investigation, figure out what the defendant's defenses are going to be, and they will often, and this is true in Colorado, there's a required conciliation period. One of the things that has frustrated us with the lack of sort of the known lack of enforcement power these days in the Title III context is you write a demand letter and 9 times out of 10 you don't even get an answer. And if you do get an answer, the answer, as even we first got in iTunes, is we're fine. Here's why the law doesn't apply, and if it did, we're fine. So it's nice to have, before you spend a lot of time on the case, the chance to sit down with a defendant, with a mediator, and try to resolve it. And again, working with public interest organizations is another way. You know, a lot of times I think defendants view a single plaintiff with a single barrier, single issue as kind of, you know, their own personal problem. And if you can come in side by side with the NFB or with the Colorado Cross Disability Coalition or DREDF or DRA, one of these many very powerful organizations, it's much harder for a business to say, oh, this is just a one-time thing. This is just a problem. But again, in closing, I just want to stress that for Title III to regain its effectiveness again, this particular decision needs to be reversed and the attorney's fee provision given back the power that it was intended to have.
Oh, sure, it's going to pick up real well. First, I want to just say what an honor it is to be able to speak here today at a conference. What's that? Yeah.
Can you just hold it up?
How's that? Okay. If your arm gets tired, I'll lean this way. What an honor it is to speak at a conference presented by an organization like the NFB that has done so much over the years to advocate for the rights of persons with disabilities. In a conference attended by some of the legends of disability rights enforcement, including Dr. Maurer and Dan Goldstein and David Furliger and many of the other folks in this room. One of the consequences of asking an attorney who spends literally every hour of every work hour of every day and some non-work hours of every day thinking and working on disability rights enforcement is you get a very tree-level view of what these issues are like. And so you're going to hear a lot today from me that focuses on the kinds of facts and efforts you need to be successful in an ADA enforcement action. And I'm hopeful that even though there's a lot of kind of boring lawyerly discussion here, focusing on those kinds of facts will be helpful to advocates who depend at least in part on bringing lawsuits to enforce ADA rights. I'm going to start with just a brief overview of the topics I hope to cover today. First, I want to talk about possible solutions to the mootness issue, the Buchanan issue that Amy just discussed. Then I want to talk about the upsides and downsides of bringing large-scale actions, either class actions or actions on behalf of organizational plaintiffs, and how to decide when to bring those kinds of actions. And then finally, I want to talk about negative perceptions of the ADA held both by the public sometimes as well as by judges. And possible ways to at least minimize some of that. And to the extent that anybody in this room has other ideas, I'm being greedy and selfish. I want to hear them because we face that all the time. Okay, let's start with mootness and Buchanan. As Amy pointed out, this whole mootness-Buchanan issue is a creature of federal law by a federal court interpreting federal statutes. So one way of addressing this is to look for state laws. State laws that are beneficial both because that will allow you on occasion to work with people like Mara and other state AG's office who are charged with enforcing those laws, but also because they can get around this federal decision. And under Erie, which is a long ago Supreme Court decision addressing when state law and when federal law applies, state law decisions that state claims that a plaintiff prevails on are decided by state law, which means that Buchanan wouldn't apply when you win on a state law. So you're looking for state laws that provide, for example, for damages or states in which the courts have rejected the approach in Buchanan. We do a lot of work, for example, in California, which has both. They've got these tremendous state laws that provide for damages for disability rights discrimination, and their Supreme Court has explicitly rejected the Buchanan approach and still believes that under California law, you have the catalyst theory. But the truth be told, there's not many states that are like California. So let's talk about other ways of addressing Buchanan and mootness. One of the most important principles or doctrines that applies to this Buchanan mootness issue is what's known as the voluntary cessation doctrine. And Amy mentioned that briefly, but the notion here is kind of common sense, which is if you've got a defendant that has been demonstrated to have violated a statute, that defendant, if they're claiming that they fixed the problem and that the plaintiff's claim is no longer viable, has a pretty heavy burden of showing that that particular violation is not going to happen again in the future. That leads to some litigation tactics. First of all, you want to look for evidence that whatever the nature of the violation is, it's likely going to occur in the future. And I'll give you an example of a real-life example of that. In the case brought by the NFB versus Target, the defendant, and that was a case, as probably most of you know, in which the NFB and the plaintiffs alleged that the website used by Target was inaccessible to blind persons. The defendant in that case then made some modifications to its website and said, hey, now we fixed the website, it's accessible, the plaintiff's claims are moot. And one of the points that the court made in rejecting that argument is that the website has new pages added to it all the time. So the fact that the website at the particular time at that stage of the litigation was accessible really said nothing about what that website was going to look like a year from then, which meant that the plaintiff's claims were not moot. So one thing is, in the beginnings of the litigation, look for that kind of evidence, that the nature of the violation is such that things change quite frequently. Another thing, another method of addressing along the same lines this mootness argument is how you characterize your claims. And I'll give you an example of an access case, kind of a silly example, unless you love condiments like I do. We often have litigated access cases, and sometimes they're restaurants. And so if you've got one of the claims is that dispensers, such as paper cup dispensers or condiment dispensers, is out of the reach of person who uses wheelchairs, you could phrase that in two different ways. One way would be to phrase it in terms of violations of the ADAG and say you have to be within X inches and it's not within reach of X inches. But another way is to talk about it as a policy and to say, look, these things are movable. The employees of the store often bring these in and out, fill them in and out, and what is going on here is a policy violation. And to the extent that you've got a policy, it's more likely that the court is going to find that a policy, if the defendant comes in and says, oh, we've changed our policy and now all employees are required to make sure that condiment dispensers are within the reach range of a person with disability, it's a lot easier to argue as a plaintiff, look, policies come and they go. And the fact that they've had this temporary litigation-inspired change in policy doesn't mean that that policy isn't going to change a year from now. Okay. Second, class actions. Class actions are, there's good and bad about class actions and large-scale actions, and I'm going to get to that as my next topic. But in terms of addressing mootness, they can be very effective. First of all, even if you're addressing simple physical changes that could be susceptible to mootness doctrine, such as asking that a facility put in a ramp. And if they do, they're going to have a pretty good argument that your case is moot. If you have a defendant that has a large number of facilities, if you bring a class action, it's just simply more complicated for them to fix all of the physical facilities than if you're talking about one particular facility. We've got a class action that's been going on for 6.5 years. That's one of the downsides of bringing class actions against Taco Bell. And they are now trying to moot out our claims by fixing all of their facilities. And they've just done a horrible job at it. First of all, there's all sorts of policies that are a problem there. But in addition, there's 220 restaurants at issue there, and they simply cannot effectively fix everything that's wrong there. And we haven't litigated the issue, but it's upcoming, and I feel pretty confident that we're going to win that simply because of the scale of the fixes and the poor performance on their part. Second aspect of class actions that's really important to addressing mootness is what's called the relate back doctrine. And this is a doctrine that has been articulated by several courts, several times by New York courts. And it says that when you have a class action and the named plaintiff's claim becomes moot, even if it becomes moot before class certification, if two circumstances apply, which I'll get to in a second, the related back doctrine says that you judge mootness by the circumstances that existed at the time the complaint was filed. And the two circumstances are, number one, that despite the fact that the named plaintiff's claims might be moot, there's still putative class members who have viable claims. And second, that the mootness, whatever occurred to moot the claim, was something that the defendant deliberately did. I'll give you an example of a Medicaid class action where this came up for us a couple of years ago. We litigated a class action against the state of Colorado because they failed to provide due process to persons with developmental disabilities when they were denied their Medicaid benefits were denied or terminated. And so we brought the class action. We had three named plaintiffs, and lo and behold, within about 4 months of bringing that action, all of their benefits were granted. And they then argued that because the named plaintiff's claims were no longer viable, they had gotten the benefits they had wanted, that our case should be dismissed. And we successfully argued, based in part on the relate back doctrine, that the fact that these defendants had obviously done it to try to get rid of this case, and the fact that there was many class members out there who still had due process violations, meant that their argument should fail, and the court bought that. Okay, switching now to the benefits of large-scale actions. And I'm referring now to two types of actions, class actions, as well as organizational plaintiff actions. And an organizational plaintiff action is, for example, the Target case that I was talking about, where a nonprofit organization, such as the NFB or many others in the country, brings an action on either behalf of itself or behalf of its members. And this means that you can cover a whole lot of facilities or an entire policy, et cetera, at one time. There's upsides and downsides to bringing these kinds of actions. But the first thing I wanted to talk about is pre-suit factors that affect whether or not to bring this kind of enforcement mechanism. And as Mara emphasized from the perspective of the AG's office, investigation before filing suit is one of the key things that helps determine whether to bring this kind of lawsuit. The stakes are high for a class action or organizational plaintiff. You've got a defendant that is potentially on the line for millions of dollars on injunctive relief, not to mention damages. You, as the plaintiff's counsel, are taking on a case on behalf of potentially thousands of people. You have an obligation to advocate for their rights. It means it's going to be potentially a very long case. It's going to be potentially a very expensive case. You want to make sure before you ever file it that you have done your homework, that you know you've got the claims to sustain the claims, the evidence to sustain the claims. And so one of the things we do is spend a long time talking to people who may be affected by the policy or the discrimination at issue, make sure that this is an actual problem, do lots of phone calls, do interview memos, all sorts of things before we ever decide to bring a case. When you bring it, the other factor is looking at the upsides and downsides. The upsides of a class action include, for example, leverage, a class action or a organizational plaintiff's case. Even if you're only seeking injunctive relief and you're not seeking damages, the fact that it's a large-scale action can have a lot more leverage in obtaining the results you want than if you bring a single plaintiff case. We have brought several class actions, injunctive only class actions, in which the defendant has quickly done exactly what we wanted. We sued AM Concert Arena, and it was large scale, so we were able to have standing to seek all sorts of relief, and within about 6 months we settled that case and they did systemic relief across the board. It's even more leverage if you bring a lawsuit seeking damages. And obviously Title III of the ADA doesn't have damages, but several states' laws do provide for damages, and you can get damages if you meet the intent standard under Title II as well as the Rehab Act. That really ups the stakes. And that talk, we'll talk a second about the downside of upping the stakes, but we have had significant success in bringing those kinds of cases and causing the defendant to make really good injunctive relief, notwithstanding the fact that they may not agree to the monetary relief. So, for example, in that Taco Bell case I was talking about, that hasn't been resolved and we're fighting over damages, but they have done a lot of fixes, not complete fixes, but a lot of fixes that they never would have done if it had not been brought as a class action. Scope of discovery. You should be entitled to pretty significant discovery, even in an individual plaintiff action, but sometimes judges find that that's not the case. And there's no doubt when you bring a class action that you're going to get a lot more information about the defendant's practices than you would if you're only bringing an individual action. And then finally, the obvious advantage is the scope of relief. If you bring a class action, you can get systemic relief across the board, whereas if you bring only a solo plaintiff case, you can only get relief that is applicable to that plaintiff. The downsides, obviously, are the costs and the delay. If you bring a class action, you've got the potential for years of litigation, and during that time, efforts by the defendant across the board to try to stop you from prevailing, and that can lead to both delay and significant expense. Okay, my last topic before we take questions is negative perceptions, both by the public and by judges. I don't know if you have seen it as much. It's really true in California that ADA actions have just gotten horrible negative press. And I know that's true in Florida as well. And we've encountered, perhaps in large part because of that kind of press, judges who are very skeptical about ADA actions. And so we've done everything we can think of, and to the extent that other folks here have ideas, it would be very helpful to try to reduce that. So, for example, we always send demand letters before we bring suit to try to get voluntary compliance. So far, we have never yet had a defendant actually agree to anything we've done before suing, which says something. We make sure that the complaint tells a compelling story. Obviously, under liberal pleading rules, you don't have to have every single fact in your complaint, but I think it's very beneficial in these kinds of cases to have a complaint that tells the judge or the press, to the extent that they're interested, why it is that these changes are affecting, you know, these kinds of violations are having an actual impact on the plaintiffs and others with disabilities. And then finally, we do a lot of press releases and press conferences before we file suit, and we'll work with the plaintiffs so that when they are asked by reporters about the case, that they have compelling stories to tell. All right, I think that's everything on my presentation, and we're willing to talk about questions.
Okay, state your name if you would.
Bob Arninger.
Bob Arninger?
Yes, how are you?
Good.
I have several just comments and hear you talk about it. Number one, the problem with New York State and the governor is a problem that's nationwide. Access and accessibility is included in civil rights laws for persons with disabilities to address discrimination, whether it's intent or effect. Steps keep you and I out of a building. It has a direct effect in doing so, whether they intended to put the steps there or not. We need to make sure that expert witnesses aren't architects. Now, there may be some architects that know how to draw a ramp, but they have to understand the implication of accessibility, and you may have to go beyond whatever it is. This has trickled over now into several decisions regarding fair housing, where there are several federal courts that have ruled that you can't claim a continuing violation of the lack of accessibility. It's in effect a statute of limitations on doing that. Well, it was interesting, in Denver, I was working with the Denver Public Housing Authority. We did an old hotel. And in the tile work in this old hotel were swastikas in some of the tiles. And they immediately took it out. And I asked them why. And they said, well, it's obvious why. Well, then why is it not obvious to take out barriers that discriminate? The other thing was that I hope that at some point we all will take a look at what's going on in the prison systems today, particularly private prisons, where inmates with disabilities are being treated to a level that may very well be cruel and unusual punishment and led to deaths. The most recent that I've heard of is Kenneth Keith Kallenbeck in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, in a private prison, who was just being held there because he was too poor to get bail, and he died. So those are the kinds of things I would like to see us. Those are my comments. I'll let you.
The members of the panel want to address any of this?
I'll speak to point one, which is the statute of limitations decisions under the Fair Housing Act, which are just horrible. Basically, what these things say is that if you're a plaintiff who has a disability and don't come to court and doesn't come to court within the statute of limitations after the building was constructed, even though you didn't even know that the building was constructed, you're out of luck. It's just ridiculous. And it actually led to a piece on Comedy Central, right? Comedy Central making fun of that.
The first known disability access Stephen Colbert piece.
Yeah, right, exactly. the one thing I would point out is that there's some good decisions on that issue under the ADA, including a Ninth Circuit decision that rejects that approach based on the language of the ADA.
One of the things that is clear that comes out of the discussions that we've had this morning is that there are legislative solutions that we should try to craft, and that we should get a legislative coalition together to work on what it is that we want. I don't know how you convince the Supreme Court that the ADA matters. So far, it hasn't taken the ADA very seriously, or at least that's my impression of it. I didn't think Kareem Dale would miss that, so I didn't bring it up this morning. The president will be appointing some justices. Other questions? Let me just say, you have to trust your lawyer. And your lawyer has to trust you. If you're going to bring a case, you have to have a lawyer who has what is needed in order for you to have faith in that person or that firm. And that person or that firm has to feel much the same about you. I was asked if we wanted the Attorney General's office to get involved in our case, and I was wondering whether or not I trusted the Attorney General, for I do not know the Attorney General in Massachusetts. So we studied this question a while, and then we came to think that it was a worthwhile risk. We did think of it as a risk. And we came to know Moira, and she is a great lady. And this has made me sanguine about doing it with other states, and so I'm looking forward to it. We have lunch coming up, and I'm sorry to have to cut things short here. I do appreciate the matter of enforcement. Enforcement is the meat of where we have to get after the laws are out there. It is delightful to have all of you here, and we'll be back at it at 1:15.